Hello, and welcome to season two of the Austin Therapy Podcast. I'm Kate. I have a background in psychology. My pronouns are they, she, and I am joined by
Teresa, I have a background in social work and my pronouns are she, they. And I am the one who has not read a ton of Jane Austen so far through season one, Pride and Prejudice in the books, starting on Northanger Abbey. So that is our season two book. If you haven't listened to season one, we encourage you to go back and listen to it. But if not, you're welcome to join us right here as you love Northanger as much as I think we will.
Yeah, Northanger is my comfort read. It is my favorite. I have multiple favorite Jane Austens, but this is my favorite Jane Austen and the one that I probably have read the most now, but also the Jane Austen book that I read last.
Like you read it most recently, or you read it last when you first read Jane Austen? It was your last one to come into your life.
Yes.
Yes, to which of those?
To both of those. It's the one that I have read last because it's one that I go back to, and it is the one that I read last in terms of the order in which I read Jane Austen books the first time. A really good pandemic read when we were in full lockdown isolation.
I do remember us having long phone calls during the pandemic, and you would talk a lot about Jane Austen, and you would talk about Mr. Tilney quite a bit. So I knew you were reading Northanger during that time because he was at the forefront of your mind.
So during the pandemic, and I probably made it about halfway through, I started writing a Mr. Tilney version of Northanger Abbey from his perspective. So I am reasonably obsessed with this book. It's the Jane Austen book that I'm the most obsessed with. Maybe that's a good way to put it. So I'm really excited for you to read this one. It's not one that a lot of people do read. It's very common, I feel like, in the Jane Austen sphere for people to be like, oh, Northanger, I haven't read that one. So if you haven't read Northanger, you get to join us along, and I hope that you join in and read along because it's such a fun book. I just really love it.
So my version of the book has a little like intro explanation about how Northanger came to be. And I don't know if that's included in every copy that's published nowadays or if that's unique to the version that I picked up. But there were a couple things in it that were kind of interesting to me. One, which I already knew because I think you had mentioned it, that Northanger, although was Jane Austen's first book that she wrote, was the last book to be published, and it was published after she died. And she was still in the process of maybe editing it. And so I think that that felt a little bit interesting. And I think we'll talk about that a little bit because there's some literary devices that she uses and writing style that she uses in this, which differs greatly from Pride and Prejudice.
Was the note in yours the biographical note by her brother?
That's a great question. It does not say by anyone. It just says introduction.
So basically, the biographical notice by Henry Austen, who was the one who published these after Jane Austen's passing, he basically identified his sister as the author, because up until this time she'd been an anonymous. She'd been anonymous without being anonymous.
And it does say that in here that it was credited to a lady.
And I think it's really interesting, I guess, note that he leaves in that he's just like, my sister deserves credit. But Persuasion and Northanger were published after her death. And as far as my understanding goes, Northanger is the first book that Austen wrote, like the first manuscript that she wrote, but she didn't publish it. And which is why it's shorter and has a different tone than almost all of her other books in terms of, shall we say, seriousness. So yeah, that was a lot of bibble babble about Northanger and all of the historical details that I probably don't have entirely correct.
And this introduction says that someone had purchased the copyright and then it just sat on a shelf. And so then, when that copyright lapsed, that's when Jane Austen went back and started making her edits towards the end of her life. The one thing that I thought was really interesting was according to this, and I'm sure there are better historians out there who might verify if this is true or not, but according to this introduction, it says that the book was originally titled Susan Northanger Abbey. And I'm so intrigued as to who Susan is.
I assume Catherine was called Susan.
It must be, because I was like, we have not met a Susan yet, and for their name to be in the title feels like they might be an important person.
So yes, she did rename the main character. She does have a unfinished manuscript that is called Lady Susan.
Huh.
And Lady Susan is a narcissist.
Oh.
It's not necessarily a romance book. She's not a nice person. So I do wonder if maybe when she wrote Susan, which was Northanger Abbey, when she sold it, maybe she had an encounter to Susan that she was like, oh yeah, I hate that bitch. And then she did. And she was like, I'm going to write about this person and make them the worst character ever. But not. Yeah. Lady Susan would be a really interesting one from a psychological standpoint for us to have a discussion about. But again, it's not considered one of the canonical six.
The wonders of Austin is that we have so much content that we can do this podcast on, which is really exciting to me.
Should we actually talk? Yes, I think the thing that we should probably also let people know is that we are doing chapter 1 to chapter 5 of Northanger for this podcast. Teresa, what did you think of your introduction to Catherine Morland?
So I wrote down, even on the very first page, I like her. She feels relatable. And then, like, it felt a little less relatable when she got older, but we'll get to that. What I thought was interesting is, so my only frame of reference to refer to is Pride and Prejudice, because that's the only one I've read. And Pride and Prejudice started off with such a profound statement, which made me feel icky anyways.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that a gentleman in good fortune must be in want of a wife.
So that as the starting point versus this one of no one who had ever seen Catherine Morland in her infancy would have supposed her born to be a heroine. Feels like a very different start. Both strong statements being made, but in very different ways. So in Pride and Prejudice, that feels more like setting the tone for the whole purpose of the novel as a whole, versus this feels like more of an intimacy connection into Catherine, specifically into the character versus like the whole book. And there's a lot of referencing in these first few chapters of she's going to be a heroine and she's on her heroine's journey. And it's very cute, but it has a very different feel to it.
So when you start reading this chapter, you get the sense that Jane Austen is being silly and there's a lightheartedness to the writing. Keep in mind that this was a satire. And so she's basically saying, Catherine's just a normal girl who doesn't have any horrible history and trauma behind her. She's not going to be a typical heroine because nobody's tried to kill her and her mother didn't die in childbirth and her father never locked her up. She's just a regular girl.
Right. She's average.
Yeah. And in some places, below average.
Yeah. She does spend a lot of time being like, yeah, she wasn't very good at any of these things.
She didn't like learning if she didn't have to.
Which I think is part of what makes her feel a little more relatable of like, as an average person, I like to think. If I was writing a book about my life, it would be like, you know, like just kind of middle of the road average. Good at some stuff and okay at other stuff. Totally average.
Typical middle class human with a very large family where her mom didn't have a lot of time to guide her education because there were six other kids in the house who were younger than her. Yeah. Three brothers who were older.
Which is a huge family.
By our standards.
True. Back then, I guess maybe not.
Well, okay. So size of family also speaks to, in some ways, the idea of middle class versus upper class. It's not like you've got three kids, you've got 10.
Interesting family makeup is what I gather. Although we don't learn a lot about her siblings. The only sibling that gets a name is her sister, Sally. Otherwise, we haven't heard of anyone else's names.
Well, Because we don't really need to.
Yeah, because maybe they're not that important. Also very average people.
Yes. This is very much setting things up of like, Catherine is the every girl.
Yes.
Right? And she's not super accomplished, and there's not going to be any question of that. She's not going to be sitting at a Lady Catherine's table and being quizzed and like, what do you know? It's just kind of like, oh, you like baseball. Okay.
You're kind of a run-of-the-mill, maybe a little rough and tumbly as a kid, you know, interested in things that maybe weren't expected of her to be interested in as a girl. And I do think part of my brain makes that connection into, until her younger siblings came along, she had three brothers. Kids often are interested in the things that their siblings are interested in. And if the brothers were pushed more into sports and things like that, I do think that that part of that origin for her interest.
I also get the impression, and I didn't highlight the line in here, but there was basically a line that was kind of like, Catherine found sitting and learning boring, and Catherine wanted to be outside playing games. And it was a little bit of like, Catherine just didn't want to do the things that she was typically supposed to enjoy. And the things that she found fun, which if she were a boy, there would be no problem.
And I think as a kid, that comes through. And then there is this shift of when she's 13, she starts being a little bit more, for lack of a better word, and very gendered, a little more girly. She's into like curling her hair and going to balls, and her features are improving. There was this one line where I was like, oh, this is kind of mean, but also like a little funny. Is Catherine grows quite a good looking girl. She is almost pretty today.
I know. So I find that line of kind of Catherine has attributes within herself that are not typically feminine. And as a child, she didn't get evaluated for her femininity or how fine a lady she was. She was allowed to be a kid. But as she's become an older teenager, she's realized that society expects her to fit into a specific category. And that is now where esteem comes from. Esteem comes from whether or not she is pretty versus whether or not she can out-hit the boys at baseball. She has had to shift the areas in which she finds esteem because she's not a boy, so she doesn't get evaluated on the same things as her brothers do. Now she has to care about how she looks. She has to care about going to balls. And there's a part of me that's kind of not sad for Catherine, but well, if an era exists where there are not stereotypes and prejudices around how men and women and the binary are supposed to be in division of roles, would Catherine have cared about these things at all? Or would she have even noticed that being called pretty was like this ultimate compliment? Or would it have just been like, eh? But it's just this weird sort of line of kind of like, her parents are nice and also horrible.
I think that that is something that Jane Austen often does, at least she did in Pride and Prejudice. The parents are awful in some ways, and in other ways, you feel for them a little bit. They're not horrible people. They might just not be the nicest parents.
Well, and I don't even get the impression that her parents aren't nice parents. They and the systems in place may have given her a little bit of a complex, and you can kind of get the impression, not that Catherine has low self-esteem, but almost unstable self-esteem, and that small compliments are going to be bigger than what they actually are if she had good self-esteem.
There is a sentence in here. To look almost pretty is an acquisition of higher delight to a girl who had been looking plain the first 15 years of her life than a beauty from her cradle can ever receive. And I think that that really speaks to, it becomes a bigger thing than it maybe would be if her self-esteem was better or her self-esteem was higher.
Or if she had been complimented on those things throughout her life instead of just her parents being like, oh, she stopped doing boy things and now she's pretty.
Huh, we woke up one day and somehow she became somewhat pretty.
Just very weird, but also you get the impression with Mrs. Bennet that sometimes she is purposely putting her children down. You don't get that here. They're literally just making what they think is a plain observation of kind of like, hey, did you notice that Catherine looks like girly today and kind of pretty? Oh, yeah. Okay.
I did write that her mother does feel quite opposite to Mrs. Bennet in that, like, she's not the overbearing parent who's like, I must marry off all my children. It essentially says, like, her older daughters kind of like did their own thing and she left them to their own devices, which feels very different.
And I think this is very true for every single heroine across Jane Austen's books. She's very different from the heroines that we saw with Lizzie and Jane, and even Lydia. She's her own sort of just naive 17-year-old in the world, but like in a much less Lydia all over everything, typically teenager sort of way. She's naive and calm and quiet. I get the impression that Catherine is very people-pleasy and not in a bad way, just kind of Catherine is kind and well-humored, but she's also still 17.
Well, and I think there's a little bit of, I read her as a bit of a daydreamer. And some of that is this like hero heroine talk to it as she's leaving home and going on this adventure. In her mind, like she's playing out these different scenarios of like, maybe the robbers will get us, but they didn't. She's living in, it's not even fantasy because I don't think she's unrealistic about it, but it is a little bit of daydreaming of how to picture the world a little bit differently. Or she's read it in a book, maybe, and has decided, oh, that could be my life. Like that could happen to me. And projecting herself onto something else, which is typical for a 17-year-old in developmental stages as they're forming their identity and forming who they are to be exploring that and to be exploring daydreaming and trying on different personas.
Right. The first chapter is kind of like Catherine grew up in a small town where nothing happened and her life was pretty plain and boring. And the biggest adventure that she ever had was when her neighbors, the Allens, said, "Hey, do you want to go to Bath with us?" And her parents were like, "Go." What did you think of her parents' like parting advice to her?
I thought it was interesting. This is where Jane Austen uses some of this, like, first person narration, but not quite. I don't really know what type of narration it is if I'm going to describe it in a literary sense, because that's not my forte. But she talks about how, of course, Mrs. Morland's going to have some anxiety, some maternal anxiety about her daughter leaving, but she didn't really know any different or didn't know anything. So her advice was like, wrap yourself up warm so you don't get a cold. Have a nice time.
Which is like, again, very clearly the Morlands have like an idealistic perspective. And in some ways, it's demonstrating that Catherine is sheltered and her parents are. Like, her whole family is sheltered. And that's not necessarily, I mean, it is a bad thing in some ways, but also what a nice way for Catherine to grow up that she wasn't like, by the way, men rape people. Be careful. Her mom's just like, don't get sick. Mind your manners. P's and Q's.
And I get the sense that it is a little bit of that like sheltered naivete on her parents' part. Whereas when Lydia went off in Pride and Prejudice, you get the sense that Mr. and Mrs. Bennet should know better. But in this, you don't get the sense that the Morlands should know better.
Right. There's no regiment that's been posted close to them, and their daughters have had experiences, or they themselves had experiences while they were courting, or their daughters coming home and being like, "Dad, please don't do this." You just get the impression that they just haven't been exposed to that part of the world that's horrible, and they're just kind of in their own happy space in the country.
It sounds like a very idyllic upbringing in lots of ways. Not a lot of bad stuff happened, which is great, kind of what everyone wishes for. So I thought that was interesting. And then her father's parting of being like, here's 10 guineas, and you can have more when you want it, versus making a big deal out of it. He's treating it as if it is a normal occurrence of, cool, you're going to go to Bath. Have a nice time.
Very casual about it. And also, like, I get the impression that there isn't this expectation, go fetch a husband. That's why you're going to Bath. Like, I want you to buy some dresses and I want you to be the finest woman in the room. It's just, hey, go have a nice vacation with our elderly neighbors and have a nice time, go to some dances, go to some shows, and then when you come back, we'll talk about it, and it'll be a nice little wholesome adventure that you had.
Go have a nice vacation, have a nice time.
It's that satire of, like you're saying, Austin sort of inserting her voice into the narrative, and also you get the impression that Catherine's also thinking this way, of like, no robbers got them. No thefts happen. Carriage did not get overturned and they didn't get introduced to a hero. It's that satire kind of like, nope, we're progressing this story without a traumatic event occurring. And making fun of sort of the gothic novel at the time, which was very dramatic. And also you get the impression that Catherine's sitting back being like, oh, is something exciting going to happen to me finally?
I will meet my prince, my one true love. He will come and rescue me. I feel like this satire feels very reminiscent to me of nowadays rom-coms. And every once in a while, I go through a phase in my life where I'm like, I want my life to be a rom-com. And I feel like that's Catherine Morland a little bit. Is she wants her life to be the gothic novel. So she's like on the lookout. And then I dropped my groceries and the handsome man at the grocery store helped me pick them up. And our hands brushed and then we fell in love.
She's like, how do I make a meet cute happen?
Exactly. She's thinking about those meet cutes, which it just, again, feels so innocent and yet hopeful. And you can't help but like her.
I'm glad you like Catherine. A lot of people find her annoying.
I mean, we're only 5 chapters in, so far I like her. We'll see if I don't continue to like her. But so far I do.
What did you think of the Allens?
Mrs. Allen annoys me a little bit, and Mr. Allen is not there, so I have no opinions of him.
Yes, that's fair. Yeah, Mrs. Allen, she seems very airheaded, and maybe that's not even accurate.
I couldn't tell if she was airheaded or if she was just very socially anxious.
Okay, I don't read her as socially anxious at all. I read her as not caring that much.
See, I think the thing that stands out for me that makes me wonder about social anxiety is she repeats several times, I wish I knew someone here. And for me, that feeling of when you've gone to a new place and you don't know anyone and you're trying to like engage into a new social setting, some people are very easy into that. They will make connections with anyone. They will make friends anywhere. People who are maybe a little more socially anxious or have a little bit of a harder time with that might be like, oh, I wish I had someone who could be my introduction person. For me as an introvert, I think of that person as my like designated extrovert that will be the person who's going out and talking to everyone and making those connections, making that introduction. And then I can kind of tag along and be like, oh, okay, other people.
I think the thing that makes me think that it's more that she's just unobservant and caring in terms of having those social connections is that she's described as having a trifling turn of mind. And it's not like she's insensible. It's not like she's someone who doesn't care. It's just that she's so unobservant to the fact that she should.
Okay, I can see that.
And I guess like when they're in the upper room, and she is repeating like, oh, I wish we had an acquaintance. Oh, I wish you could dance. The thing that always gets me is when they go and they sit in the tea room and she's just like, is my dress torn? She really cares about her clothes and about fashion and about, I don't even know if it's so much how she looks. She just likes fashion. And Catherine's like, how uncomfortable is this that we're sitting at somebody else's table and we don't know anyone? How do you not get that this is uncomfortable? And she's like, oh, yes, this is very uncomfortable. And she's just like very calm and cheerful about it. She's unbothered.
I didn't read it in that tone.
Ah.
I read it in the like, she is a little worried and anxious. And the worrying about her dress gives me that anxious energy of, I don't know anyone here, so I don't have anything else to focus on. So I'm going to worry about my dress and how I look. And I'm going to catastrophize things a little bit. So that was the way I read it. Hearing you say that does make me think about it a little bit differently. But on initial read, it read differently to me. A little more anxious, a little more bothered than what you read from it.
I guess the energy that I get from her is not so much anxious, maybe more restless.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like when she says, I wish we had a larger acquaintance here, she actually wishes they had a larger acquaintance, but she doesn't know what else to say to Catherine. And she's not actually very good at small talking. And she's going to go back to the thing that she knows, which is like, how do I look? And I get sort of the understanding that in terms of the marriage that she has, she's a little bit of like trophy wife. Her husband doesn't really engage with her very often. It's just very kind of, she is an object in the relationship that she's a wife because she's quiet and for the most part, well-humored. But he's not going to engage in a conversation with her because she's not very smart.
And it does kind of hint at that when she's first described. I think the line is, Mrs. Allen was one of that numerous class of females whose society can raise no other emotion than surprise at there being any men in the world who could like them well enough to marry them. She had neither beauty, genius, accomplishment, nor manner. The air of a gentlewoman, a great deal of quiet, inactive, good temper, and a trifling turn of mind were all that could account for her being the choice of a sensible, intelligent man like Mr. Allen. So it does give a little bit of that trophy wife. You're not entirely sure why they're together, but you're also kind of like, well, okay, yeah, I get why they're together.
Well, and it's not like they're unhappy. They're just very different people. I also get the impression that Mr. Allen, I don't want to say that he's not a good husband, but he literally just, they get to the upper rooms and he just leaves. Bye, ladies. I'm going to go play with my friends. And you get the impression that when they go to Bath, they don't have a Catherine with them, that Mrs. Allen would have been sitting in that tea room all by herself.
And maybe because that's her experience, that's why she would be unbothered by it. Because that's just her normal.
Right. Thinking of it in that context, maybe that's also part of why she wanted Catherine to come along, was that she didn't want to sit in those awkward situations by herself.
She wanted a companion. She wanted a friend to come along with her. Can you do a little bit of education for me historically? So I get what the tea room is. It's where you go and sit and have tea. But I don't necessarily understand the distinction between the upper and the lower rooms and when you go to which one and why.
The Bath assembly rooms were buildings within Bath that were designed by John Wood the Younger. But they're essentially the social gathering places. And Bath is like a seaside retreat town. Often used, like as they say in this, for treating medical things like Mr. Allen, I think he has gout. That's why they're going to Bath, so that he can take in the waters, because the waters were supposed to have healing properties. Seaside towns were social places that you could go. And so the upper rooms and the lower rooms were social gathering places. So the upper rooms, or the new rooms, were basically a new set of rooms that were designed that became where fashionable society went. The lower assembly rooms were the original assembly rooms consisting of two buildings, gathering places, but the upper rooms were the newer fashionable place to go. The upper rooms were newer, nicer, fancier, but they both were areas where they would have hosted events like dances. The upper rooms probably had some concerts going on, and not just, hey, we're going to go and take the waters. It's, hey, we're going to take the waters and look at all of these social activities that we have. It's like a seaside town that's the equivalent of like going for an all-inclusive cruise or an all-inclusive vacation. It's like, hey, you came with someone who's taking the waters? Well, there's also parties and theater and shows going on. So the upper rooms and the lower rooms were just the assembly rooms in Bath where people would go and they would socialize. It is a question that should probably be posed to people who have more knowledge than I do. And the thing about Austin does have a few episodes talking about Bath and the pump rooms.
That makes sense. I wasn't sure if there was like a huge distinction between who went where and why. Considering they went to both, I assume there wasn't that big of a distinction in that way. But that makes a lot of sense. So we do get to the lower room, and very quickly, chapter 3, we are meeting our hero, I guess, in this he would be, Mr. Tilney, which feels a heck of a lot faster than how long it took us to meet Mr. Darcy in Pride and Prejudice, because that book went on and on and on for the first little bit of like, I don't care, just introduce us. So I was really glad we got to the point real quick here.
What did you think of Tilney?
He seems nice. I wrote down, he's cute. Which I wrote that to when he addresses her and says, I have hitherto been very remiss, madam, in the proper attentions of a partner here. I have not yet asked you how long you have been in Bath, whether you were ever here before, whether you have been to the upper rooms, the theater, and the concert, and how you like the place altogether. I have been very negligent. But are you now at leisure to satisfy me in these particulars? If you are, I will begin directly. And I love the humor. He's very playful. And it's very cute of him being like, oh yeah, we've been chatting for a while. Here are all the questions that proper society says I should ask you. So let me ask you those questions.
So I get that this is a little bit of you're on a first date with someone and you're having some really good conversation flow and there's a little bit of a lull and someone goes, you know, I haven't asked you the typical like first date questions. What do you do for work? What is a typical Saturday for you? Do you have any pets? But very sarcastically being like, we've been enjoying ourselves, but like, let me feel the obligation of first date questions. And he's so cute. He's so cute.
It feels very flirtatious to me between the two of them from the get-go of like there's a little bit of teasing, but more at the situation, not at each other. Like it doesn't feel like they're being mean to each other, but it does feel like they're both kind of in on this inside joke of, yeah, let's answer these ridiculous questions.
And like his, how long have you been in Bath? And she says, a week. And he goes, really? She's like, why are you surprised? And then he goes back to his regular voice and he's like, why indeed? But some emotion must appear to be raised by your reply, and surprise is more easily assumed and not less reasonable than any other. Now let us go on. Were you never here before, madam? And like slips back into sarcasm. And it is very, very playful. Like you can tell that he's trying to see if he can get Catherine to laugh.
Well, and I love that he like concludes this section with the, now I must give one smirk and then we may be rational again. And I just love that he, through all of it, you can tell he knows exactly what he's doing and he knows how he's playing it and how it is a little funny and a little ridiculous and how fun that can be and how playful they can be together in this.
It just automatically lets you know that Mr. Tilney's lighthearted. And it's a lightheartedness that never gets pointed at Catherine, where he's talking about journaling, and it's very clear in that he's both poking fun at himself, poking fun at culture, poking fun at like the expectation of what women do, but you never get the impression that he is making fun of Catherine.
Well, and I can just picture Jane Austen writing this and laughing to herself and being like, haha, I'm so funny. The depth of Mr. Tilney that she builds into this so quickly in such a humorous way.
Yeah, you automatically know who he is. And just charming, but not from that place of like intentionally manipulating Catherine. He's having a little flirty fun with a girl that he seems to like.
Right. It's not puppy dog energy like we saw with Bingley. It feels a little more grounded, but still like humorous and playful.
Okay, so I think the difference between Bingley puppy dog energy and Mr. Tilney is having fun in this silly, playful way with confidence.
Yes.
Whereas Bingley very much is like, please let me please you. What do you want to hear me say? And Tilney is very in control of this conversation.
That's an excellent way to describe it. And Catherine seems to be holding her own in this conversation too, which I appreciate. I don't get the sense that like this guy is laughing at her or walking circles around her. It does feel like a good back and forth between the two of them.
Yes. What did you think of Tilney's impression of how women write?
I think it was interesting. He essentially is like, here's exactly what you're gonna say. You're gonna say that like I am some strange weird man who made me dance with him and it was a very awkward weird encounter.
He's very self-deprecating.
Very. But then he turns it on its head and says, what you should write though is that I danced with a very agreeable young man introduced by Mr. King, had a great deal of conversation with him. Seems a most extraordinary genius. Hope I may know more of him. I just love that he turns it from like, you must think I'm crazy, to like, here's what you should actually think. But in such a playful way.
Right. It's the, you might think I'm crazy, but actually, you know, I'm a genius.
I just really appreciated that and really liked that.
And I like that Catherine is engaging in the playfulness too, where he's like, you know what you're going to write in your journal? And then she's like, what if I don't keep a journal? And he's like, don't keep a journal. He teases her. But again, it's teasing her from this objective place of kind of, I know all ladies keep a journal. And he's knows he's fully being ridiculous.
And she does too. Like, she's playing along with it.
Well, there are many moments where she's trying not to laugh.
They're enjoying each other's company. And you can tell that also because she spends much of the next few chapters being like, when am I going to see him again?
He left an impression.
Yeah, he left an impression, which for the first guy she's really talked to in this novel, like, that's a pretty big impression to be leaving.
Also in her probably life.
Yeah, they talk about how back home there are no men. The reason she's going to Bath and might find someone is because there's no one at home to find.
One of the things that I really like about Tilney through this exchange is when they start talking about, Catherine's like, I don't actually think women write better than men. And then he is critical in, again, sort of playful judgmental. And Catherine's like, oh, never mind. I shouldn't have been worried about you praising us too much. And he basically goes on to say that women are not superior, but also men are not either. And every power of which taste is the foundation, excellence is pretty fairly divided between the sexes. And I like that acknowledgement where he's not trying to get Catherine to like him by being like, women are amazing and better than men. He's just like, some women are better than other men and some men are better than other women, but generally there's equality. But I think, and you hold this in your mind as we read through, that Tilney is one of the most feminist men in Austen.
Well, and I was going to say, for Jane Austen in that time, and we talked about how her writing was quite progressive in lots of ways, for her to be able to write a character who was talking about equality between the sexes in that era is huge. And particularly to be writing about that from a man's perspective, or having like a male lead talk about that. So I did write in here, I wonder how much writing was an outlet for Jane Austen to really be able to share some of her political views. And
Tilney has this, I think his character lacks superiority, which is, I think, again, knowing that this is one of the first manuscript that she wrote, you get the impression that this is the kind of man that Jane Austen would want if she was going to get married. It's kind of like, I want a guy who's funny and smart, not superior, who knows that I'm a genius in my own ways, who respects women, who respects me. Very based standards, but just from the get-go. You know all of this about Tilney just from this conversation.
Well, you know all this about Tilney, but I do think, especially because Jane Austen does insert her own voice into this quite a bit, this feels more intimately connected to Jane Austen as a person. And like, I didn't know her. I was not alive then. I will never know Jane Austen. But I do get a little bit more of a sense of who she is as a person, not just as an author, through this writing.
Yeah. What did you think of Tilney's interaction with Mrs. Allen?
I mean, at this part, Mrs. Allen starts to annoy me a little bit. I'm like, go away. No one cares.
We were having fun.
Yeah. And you are here now talking about your dress. No one cares. I did note that he is a brother and presumably a big brother, because we've talked about how Jane Austen has a thing for older brothers in her male characters. So I imagine his sister is younger and that she's trusted him to choose her muslins before, and just how like sweet that is. And again, kind of a little bit of that softening of him, of he is also not a man afraid to be like, cool, I'm going to pick this outfit for my sister. Like, that's totally cool and normal and fine.
I think it also speaks to what makes men in a lot of contexts attractive. And he's like, well, if I want to hang out and talk with women, I'm going to learn about what they know about, and I'm not going to treat it as though it is something that is beneath me or beneath my learning, or not something that has its own complexities and knowledge that has to go into and behind it. You have to learn things. And he is charming, but he is charming because he's someone who puts in effort
and he pays attention.
Yeah.
Like, even this part about Catherine's dress and how he's like, I don't know if that's gonna wash well, that might fray. And Catherine having this moment of being like, you're weird, dude. Like, men don't talk about these things or know these things. I don't know these things.
Well, I also think that this interaction, and pray, sir, what do you think of Miss Morland's gown? It is very pretty, madam, said he, gravely examining it. But I do not think it will wash well. I'm afraid it will fray. How can you, said Catherine, laughing, be so? And she had almost said, strange. And I don't think she's calling him out for being strange because he's talking about muslin. I think it's the negging that he does of like, she has a very pretty dress, but I think it will fray. And I think he is strange and odd. But also in that moment in talking with Mrs. Allen, he is engaging with Catherine and kind of being like teasing the tedium of Mrs. Allen's questions, while also engaging with Mrs. Allen in a conversation that he knows will interest her. There's so much intelligence in that moment of him just being, he's continuing to be silly in front of Mrs. Allen, but also still probably knowing his silliness is undetectable by someone like Mrs. Allen.
Yes. Well, and I think some of that comes through as like he's very genuine to himself and he feels very authentic. I don't get the sense he's putting on airs for anyone in this.
Do you think that if you had not been exposed to the fact that he is the hero and having read Pride and Prejudice, you might be sitting back in this moment being like, is he Wickham?
It's hard for me to know. Here's what I'll say. I think if this was our very first book, if we had not read Pride and Prejudice first, so if this was where we were starting, I would be highly suspicious of him, as I was highly suspicious of Bingley when we started reading Pride and Prejudice.
Because he's too nice.
Because he's too nice, and I like him, and therefore there must be something wrong.
I like you. What's wrong with you?
Exactly. But I think having read Pride and Prejudice and knowing how Jane Austen treats her male characters, and even like thinking back on Wickham, there was always an edge. So you could always kind of tell, like, there's something there. I don't feel that in this.
You got the impression that Wickham wanted something. Whereas you read this and you're like, I have no idea what Tilney's goal in this conversation would be other than to, like, tease Catherine and make her laugh.
Right, and have a nice time.
I like that when they're going back to go do the dancing, Catherine's thinking about how silly he is. And he's like, what are you thinking about? And she's like, nothing, nothing at all. And he's like, oh, that is so artful and deep to be thinking of nothing. I'd rather you just told me that you did not want to tell me. And I really like that line and the way that this interaction happens, because it sets up a relationship where he's like, honesty is important to me. And he does it in this very playful way of saying, like, if you don't want to tell me something, you're allowed to say that. You don't need to people please me.
He sets a good foundation.
Right? And it's such a mature but silly and playful way that he does it.
It's really nice. And it's nice so early on to know at least what one of the expectations of a relationship would look like. And whether that relationship is friendship or romantic or something else, like, you know, at the base of it, his expectation is like, just be honest with me.
Well, and then when she says, well, fine, I will not tell you, he goes on to be like, good, we're about to know each other, and now I have something that I can tease you about. And he brings it back to playfulness, very much setting this foundation of kind of, I like to tease, And that's part of my personality. So if you're going to be my friend, I'm going to tease you about these things. But it's very not boundary crossing teasing. And it is non-confrontational teasing. And this teasing shouldn't matter. And it's very playful. And it's just such a good, mature way to communicate who he is and how he functions without being like, okay, so here's what you need to know about me.
It's showing rather than telling us exactly what we need to know about Tilney.
Well, he's showing Catherine versus just telling Catherine, which I think is, when we're talking about like first dates and relationships, a really good way to approach things and approach people is, I very much think if Tilney were interacting with someone and they were very serious and they weren't laughing and joking along with him or playful of like, what if I don't keep a journal? He wouldn't want to be acquainted with that person. And he has enjoyed Catherine in that he got to be teasing and playful and it was fun.
Yeah, I think you get the sense that he is putting his energy and time into the things he wants to put his energy and time into.
He's being himself.
Yeah.
And I also think you're right that in the way that he talks about things, I never get the impression that he's like, my goal is to like marry someone. He's just like, I want to be acquainted with you. You're funny. Like, let's dance together while I'm in Bath. And he is saying like, we're going to form a friendship. And he's not putting out expectations for Catherine that she's going to all of a sudden fall in love with him. He's just like, yeah, let's be friends and see where things go.
And then he disappears and she does not see him again. At least through the 5 chapters we read.
Yes. But before we get to that, I do want to say that this was a really nice moment where I did like Mr. Allen, because he does check up on who Mr. Tilney is and who Catherine is spending time with. And he is, at the base level, a good chaperone and does that background check. And I'm like, good. Okay, like you're a good guy. You might be a little bit absent, but like you're a good guy and you're keeping her safe, which you get the impression maybe didn't happen when Lydia went away.
Yeah, he at least knows the basics of, let me figure out, is this guy really who he says he is? Is he truly a clergyman? What's his family like? Tell us about that.
Right. And like doing some checking, and the Allens are obviously around and like they're actually chaperoning Catherine's interactions. Mrs. Allen may be a little annoying in that she ruins the flirtatious talk that's going on, but they're not interfering. They're like, go have fun, Catherine. But they're also chaperoning and they're around. And you don't get the impression that Catherine's just like going off having intimate conversations with men on her own. They're protecting her in the ways that they should.
Right. They've taken the responsibility of, your parents have entrusted you to us as a minor to chaperone. Therefore, we will chaperone you.
Yeah. And they may be silly people and a little bit absent, but they still are nice, kind, caring people.
They're well-intentioned, at least.
So I wanted to say that before we move on to chapter 4, and we basically just spend 2 chapters being like, where's Tilney?
Although I was happy that they made friends with the Thorpes. I'm happy that Catherine has someone her age to talk to. And I think someone who's not Mrs. Allen, because she annoys me.
Something I will point out that I think is important is that Isabel is around the same age as Catherine, but she is a few years older. And I think that's significant in that Catherine is 17 and she's got this friend now, Isabella, who is a little bit older than her, has been around, who knows like when two people are smiling at each other, that means that they're flirting. And like Catherine has this relationship with Isabella that is, like, imagine if you were 17 and the 24-year-old decided to be your friend. Isabella seems super cool. And there's, I guess, like a starstruckness that I kind of get the impression of in that relationship. And I don't know if you did, but it's something that I noted having read through a few times to be kind of like, ah, this dynamic in the relationship makes sense, that Catherine is kind of like a blank slate and she's going into these relationships like, this is going to be her first friend outside of her family.
Well, and it's a little bit of that, like, let me take you under my wing and kind of show you the rope, show you around so that you understand how the world functions outside of your home and outside of your family, which I think is really sweet and thinking of Lydia. Had Lydia had someone like that, maybe things would have been a little different.
Right. Someone who wasn't equally as silly as she was.
Exactly. And wasn't family, because I do think it comes off differently from family.
Well, she did go being chaperoned by her friend who was like basically Isabella's age married to an old man. But the friendship was very... Well, we'll see how Catherine's friendship developed. We can come back to that assessment of Lydia's circumstances to Catherine's circumstances.
I think that'll be interesting just to see. But at this point, at least, it feels like it's a nice connection and relationship for Catherine to have Isabella as a confidant and as someone to kind of show her around.
Yeah, and have fun with. Mr. Tilney's not around, so she's got a different friend that she can have some fun with.
Exactly. There was a line in here that I just wrote, gay. Which was, Catherine then ran directly upstairs and watched Miss Thorpe's progress down the street from the drawing room windows. And it's like that little bit of infatuation with someone of like, oh, I gotta go watch them walk away. I was like, this is so like queer-coded. There have been many times in my life where that is kind of a fine line of like, are we friends or is there something more? And like a little bit of that infatuation there. So I think if this book was written in a different era, that could be part of this. It is not written in a different era though.
I also want to highlight the fact that queer people existed, and oftentimes some of the things that queer people are like, ah, it's queer coding, may actually be queer coding in that people were actually bisexual but had to fit into heteronormative standards. So they had these intimate desires and romantic feelings towards friends, but that got classified as friendship. But when they had it towards the opposite sex, it was romance. But they would do those romantic things with friends, but it would never cross that boundary because societally and systematically it wasn't supposed to. Because as I was reading, the thought popped into my head, is Mr. Tilney maybe bi?
Oh, I don't have a read on that from our one conversation.
Okay, I'm going to keep that question in mind as we continue to read through, because it's a new sort of question that popped into my head as I was reading through. Not because Mr. Tilney is interested in the things that women are interested in, but because he very just clearly sees that men and women are equal beings in all things, that he's not trying to argue for the superiority of either. And I was kind of like, is this maybe like a hint towards the fact that Mr. Tilney's kind of like, yeah, I like girls and I like boys. I like men and I like women.
Or maybe gender is not part of that picture of him choosing who he likes.
Yeah, maybe he's pan in that he just likes people because he likes people and doesn't see gender as something that raises someone in superiority over the other. But that was a queer question that I was having around, kind of also because I love Mr. Tilney. As you said, we had many conversations before you even read Jane Austen about Mr. Tilney, and I only like queer men. So I was like, that must be it. He must be queer.
I don't think I have enough information about him to make an assessment on that. I mean, literally, I've had 2 pages of him. That's not enough for me to say one way or the other, but I do think we should pin that and come back to it.
Okay, a question that we will continue to ask. What do you think about the Morlands knowing James Thorpe?
I think it's an interesting connection. Part of me wonders, are we looking at a future marriage? My guess is that presumably if the other families don't have a lot of sons, there's probably also like not a lot of other children around in the community. So maybe there's not a marriable sister in their community. So I wondered about that. It didn't seem like they had a bad impression of James, which is good. It seemed favorable. He had come and spent some time with their family.
I just think it's really interesting that you meet random strangers on the street and they're like, oh my God, we know your brother.
Right. Your brother came to vacation with us. Is it that weird though? I feel like in that era, because things were so class specific, you spent time with people in your class and everyone in your class is doing the same things, going to the same places, seeing the same people.
I don't think it's super astonishing, but it is a happy coincidence, I guess.
I could see that. It is nice. I think that that also makes me feel like Catherine's maybe being set up for success in that friendship. There's an intimacy between the families already.
It can be an explanation of why they fall into the friendship so quickly. I do like that Austin at the end of chapter 4 is basically describing the family as like, Mrs. Thorpe is a widow, she's not rich, her oldest daughter was beautiful, and her younger sisters were also pretending to be as pretty as their older sister. And that's all the account that I'm going
to
give.
Right, that's all you need to know.
And the implication is that Mrs. Thorpe spent a really long time sitting and letting Mrs. Allen know about the tragedies of her life. And Austin's just kind of like, Mrs. Thorpe could have talked, which might otherwise be expected to occupy the 3 or 4 following chapters, in which the worthlessness of lords and attorneys might be set forth, and conversations which had passed 20 years before be minutely repeated. And Austin's kind of like, we don't need to know the inner and outs of this person's trauma. I'm not trauma dumping on my audience. Let's move on.
Which I appreciated, because I do think that differs from Pride and Prejudice, where there are times where I'm like, I don't care, Jane Austen, move on. The description of this family's intimacies don't feel that important. Let's keep moving. And oftentimes it does come back around to being important. I get it. But when I'm reading it, there were times where I'd be like, why are we talking about this? Let's keep moving. Back to the romance. Back to Darcy. Let's go.
I mean, and I do think it hints at the fact that the most important thing about Mrs. Thorpe is that she's a widow and she's not very rich and that her daughter's pretty.
Right. And she does have a son, though. So at least she's not a widow with daughters to marry off without an heir.
Right. And then the relationship progresses. Catherine spends a lot of time looking for Mr. Tilney, trying to see if he's gone to the pump rooms, the upper rooms, the lower rooms. Where's he hanging out? And she kind of comes to this conclusion that he has left.
Which I wrote, boo, I'm sad. Come back.
And Isabella kind of encourages her, kind of like, I'm sure he's very amiable and he must be a very handsome guy if you like him this much. And yeah, I think it's cute to see Catherine, not like Catherine like fell in love with him after one conversation, but she's disappointed very clearly.
Yeah, she's infatuated. She's interested in like, I want to see that guy again. That could be interesting.
Yeah. Ugh, we were going somewhere. You were funny. We were flirty. Where'd you go? Yeah. What do you think about them reading novels together?
I thought it was nice. I did write here, Jane Austen really likes women who read. There's like always scenes of someone's reading. And I think it is a test of how she describes her characters, how they relate to books.
Yes. I'm trying to find the actual term. I knew it at one point. I made a meme about this, where basically what happens is an author is like, I'm going to pause the story so that I can rant about something. And I love Austen for this, where she's like, yes, novels. Oh my God. And she's very much going at the critique that novels are what only for like women, and that they're not like in-depth and intellectual, and that they often get abused in literature. And it's like, if you're not reading classical men, then obviously you're not reading good books. And that, oh, what are you reading? Oh, it's just a novel. And I very much feel like this sentiment continues, especially around how some people will respond when you tell them that you read romance books, and they'll try and disparage you for reading romance books. And Austen just has the best response. And I just love it. And I think if we're picking quotes, I mean, I'll give you one. Smirk is amazing because I love Tilney, but I love this. It's only Cecilia or Camilla, or Belinda, or in short, only some work in which the greatest powers of the mind are displayed, in which the most thorough knowledge of human nature, the happiest delineation of its varieties, the liveliest effusion of wit and humor are conveyed to the world in the best chosen language. You should just hear her being like, And she's like, yeah, I'm reading romance books. And you know what? They're amazing. And they tell you so much about human nature. And everybody should be reading these books because they are psychological phenomena that speak to how we actually exist in the world and what we want the world to look like. And like, oh my God, how do you not understand that these are intellectual genius pieces?
Well, and I do think in there, she's also talking about like, women don't need to tear each other down in order for them to be successful. And this quote's a little bit higher up, the, if the heroine of one novel be not patronized by the heroine of another, from whom can she expect protection and regard? I cannot approve of it. Let us leave it to the reviewers to abuse such effusions of fancy at their leisure, and over every new novel to talk in threadbare strains of the trash with which the press now groans. Let us not desert one another. We are an injured body. And it just feels so poignant of, we can all support each other and this can be really good for all of us. And we write good stuff. Let's keep doing it. Let's keep bolstering each other up. There's no reason to tear each other down.
And I think she is highlighting that Catherine and Isabella enjoy reading books together. And this isn't a frivolous thing for them to enjoy together. This is a meaningful thing.
They're creating a connection on another level. They've created an emotional connection. They're now also creating an intellectual and literary connection with one another.
And I think it speaks to the hierarchy of knowledge, which, like, if we're going back and analyzing what Tilney talked about and the hierarchy of knowledge within that, Tilney very much said, just because women are interested in it doesn't mean it's something we have to put down. And that there is value and intellect that has to go into this. It just may look different than reading a textbook.
Yeah, that connection between all of these characters and Jane Austen, of they're all coming from the same value base.
Yeah, I mean, I just love how angry Austen gets.
Well, and I think that that is part of what makes this interesting, is that because we get Jane Austen's voice interjected into this book, it feels very different.
Oh, yeah. This is a very different read and a much more lighthearted read than Pride and Prejudice.
And if we're thinking ahead to like predictions, and I think that's one of the things I'm most excited about. It was a weird start to reading it because it was unexpected for me to have that like interjection of Jane Austen's voice into this. But I think I'm really looking forward to continuing to have her insights into both this novel, this relationship, and the time period within which she was writing. It's maybe not a prediction, but like something I'm really looking forward to.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else that you want to interject or draw attention to in these five chapters?
I don't know. I liked them. I'm feeling good. I like it so far. It feels very different. So I will say there is a little part of me that's worried that if this isn't my favorite book, you're going to be disappointed in me.
No. And like Mansfield Park, I will say, is my favorite in terms of the depth of a read, and that there's so much to analyze there. And it's such an intelligent book that I also call Mansfield Park my favorite book. But this one is my favorite for romance. Mansfield Park's character analysis. I don't know if you can call Mansfield Park a romance, really. We'll get there. We'll get there. But if this isn't your favorite, that's fine. I might judge you for your favorite, but everybody's allowed to have a different favorite.
Well, as long as we have that understanding, because I don't know yet. I mean, so far, my favorite is Pride and Prejudice, but that's because that's the only book I've read. So it's pretty easy to make that my favorite. When I have read all of them, we'll do an analysis of who ends up being the favorite of what and which book ends up being the favorite.
I'm curious to see if the things that make me swoon are going to be the same things that make you swoon.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess we'll have to wait and see.
Anything else?
No, I think if I'm making my predictions for what comes next, my hope is that Mr. Tilney comes back. Considering this is a much shorter book, I'm expecting not to have to go that many chapters without seeing him. So I'm predicting that he'll come back sooner rather than later. I'm going to throw out the prediction in there that something happens with Isabella and James, that there's some connection there. And we already got dancing, but maybe we'll get some more.
So not a prediction, but a hope.
It is always a hope.
You like the dancing, huh?
I think if I lived in Regency times, I just want to go to balls and dance all day. It's so pretty and it's fun that everyone knows the same dances.
This is like the part of you that would go do line dancing and square dancing. That's like, I like this coordinated dancing.
It is 100% the part of me that likes square dancing and line dancing. 100%.
And I think I would despise that because I lack the coordination to be able to do the dance as well. I think even if I had learned them, I probably would find it less fun than you. And I would be a wallflower and someone who stepped on toes, where I feel like you would be my extroverted buddy who would be like, dance. Who wants to dance? Let's go dance.
I would still step on people's toes and be highly uncoordinated. I'd just be having too much fun to care.
Right. I feel that you're either a really good dancer or you have a really good, fun, jovial personality. Ideally, you have both. And to be fair, if we were back in that era, we would have spent a significant amount of time learning these dances. And that would be a significant part of our social education. So we would probably have different feelings and sentiments around that. But this is my social anxiety speaking, being like, what is wrong with you, Teresa?
And I'm like, it'd be fun. You'd get to dance.
I'm like, yeah, but I prefer nowadays when I can just dance on my own.
Do you have a favorite quote? You've kind of already said it.
I mean, I love her rant. What was your favorite quote?
My favorite quote was, it's in the very end of the first chapter. It's, but when a young lady is to be a heroine, the perversiveness of 40 surrounding families cannot prevent her. Something must and will happen to throw a hero in her way. And not necessarily that second part of like something must and will happen, because I think that then puts things a little bit more into fate's hands. But that first half of that quote feels very much like you can write your own story. Just because there aren't any men around who you can marry because they don't live here in your tiny village does not mean that your chances of love or falling in love don't exist. It will happen for you and you will find a way to make it happen.
So I highlighted it within the same area. If adventures will not befall a young lady in her own village, she must seek them abroad. I like that. And then, now I must give one smirk, and then we will be rational again. And I just wrote, oh, Tilly, I love you.
Those are both very, very sweet.
I'm just going to go through and read all of my favorite quotes. In every power of which taste is the foundation, excellence is pretty fairly divided between the sexes. And I just said, fuck, he's sexy. And then friendship is certainly the finest balm for the pangs of disappointed love.
Yeah, that one was really nice. They're good chapters. So far, I am quite enjoying it. It feels like it moves a little bit faster than Pride and Prejudice, which was one of my critiques.
This novel is much more fun. It's written to be fun.
Yeah, well, it's a satire.
She's satiring gothic novels. It's great. I love it.
So what are we reading next?
We're going to read chapter 6, 7, and 8.
We do want to throw it out there that as of the recording of this, Spotify Wrapped has just come out. And so we're very excited that some people have let us know that we made it into their top 5. We're very honored and very confused by this, but we're really glad that people enjoy listening to us and coming along on this adventure and having fun with us. So a lot of gratitude from myself. And I don't want to speak for you, Kate, but I think a lot of gratitude from me too.
We are bad advocates for the podcast and bad sellers of the podcast. I feel like when I talk about it with people, one, I forget that I talked about it. And I'm like, here's this cool, interesting thing that I've told you about 3 times. And two, I very much encourage people not to listen to the podcast. And I say, if you haven't read Jane Austen and you want to listen to some podcasts about Jane Austen, here are the other ones you should listen to. So I'm always surprised when people love the podcast and listen to the podcast, because this is mostly the thing that I tried to do to manipulate you into reading Jane Austen, and it's worked. So the fact that we're also popular and that people like us, bonus on top of that, that we're cool.
Yeah, I think that was never our intention. It's this like happy accident that has happened that we're just really excited about. And we did talk before the start of this podcast that if we make it into the under 100 or top 100 listened to in your area, we'll come and travel to your area. So we're sitting around 150 popularity in a couple of places like Australia and Sweden and South Africa. I think so. If you really want us in your area, spread the word and we'll come visit.
I don't think we've cracked the top 150. We've cracked the top 200 in fiction.
So if we get it under 100, we'll come visit. For people who have listened to the podcast, I move around quite a bit and travel quite a bit. Kate does not as much, so that's a big ask from Kate, I think. And maybe I'm speaking for you, but I think it would be a big thing for you to go somewhere because we've cracked the top 100. It would also be a big thing for me, but I'm also just more likely to show up places because I do that.
Yeah, no, I'm not a good traveler. So I will commit to traveling to somewhere if we make the top 100 podcasts to visit fans. But I don't think that's going to happen.
I mean, I don't either, but I also didn't expect anyone to listen to our podcast. So stranger things have happened.
So that's the start of Northanger Abbey. Really excited for you guys to come along for season two. We're also going to disperse some of the Pride and Prejudice mini series episodes in between. So hopefully we can get some consistent content out there for you. But yeah, we're having fun. We hope you're having fun. And thanks for listening.
All right, we'll see you next time.
Bye.